Can we just be honest for a minute? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hello to the folks out there in WLRY land on this Friday. Glad to be with you all and glad to be with Barry again in the studio here in beautiful Westerville.
Beautiful place. The snow's crisp on the ground. It's gorgeous here. There's still some sunlight in the sky because I got here early enough that we can do this recording. If you've been with us this week, we've been talking about constitutional abuses. And yesterday we talked about a critical legal theory that's being put forth by someone who's peddling a book. The book they're peddling is called On Constitutional Disobedience, and the person who's peddling it is no Johnny-come-lately to progressive leftist legal theory. He is a gentleman by the name of Louis Michael Seidman. Now, Louis Michael Seidman, none of you really know unless you listened to our program yesterday, which that means all of you know. He is the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. We talked about the pedigree and the history of Harvard Law School yesterday with Christopher Columbus Langdell and the evolutionary view of law that became case law studies, which is what I'm sure Professor Seidman teaches at Georgetown Law. And he was also a former law clerk for Thurgood Marshall, one of the court's most left-wing justices. And he is a notable figure, according to the American Thinker website, which we're referencing one of their articles, called Subverting the Constitution. He is a notable thinker in leftist, quote, critical legal theory movement. Now, if that sounds kind of hoity-toity to you, that's because that's like higher criticism. The same thing that was used to try to attack the Bible by progressives and liberals is being used to attack the foundations of constitutional law.
Very important to understand that this was a big movement in the 70s and 80s, and the entire impetus of the movement was to reshape society based on a vision of human personality devoid of hidden interest and class domination.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, that's don't good. You like that? Perceived like in that. Existing legal institutions. I'm reading this, of course, from Wikipedia. And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. Never take anything said in Wikipedia verbatim, although I have read other things that lead me to conclude that this particular statement on Wikipedia is okay.
It is safe, yes.
Yes. I'm no complete neophyte as far as critical legal studies goes. I've read some other things on it. So I know enough to know that this statement is okay.
Critical legal theory is how you look at law through different lenses. Now, some of those lenses are deconstructionism. Some of those are feminist theory. Some of those are oppressed minority theory. Some of those are special interest theories like gay rights. How do we look at justice in law, and how do we create justice for these disparaged groups?
Well, let's talk about one of, we were just laughing about this off air, Georgetown University's most recent legal graduate.
Most famous recent legal graduate,
and look for her to show up as a candidate for Senate or to head a department within the next few years. It's Sandra Fluke.
That's right. And if that name is unfamiliar to our listeners, shame on you.
Yes.
Sandra Fluke was marched out by Nancy Pelosi and others as the face for the war on women, ladies and gentlemen. She was the one who was crying the blues because Georgetown's insurance policies wouldn't cover contraceptives and birth control so that all those good legal minds could be doing something other than studying their law books most of the time.
Yes, let's just say. But it was all specially constructed rhetoric that would allow discussion of the issue, basically divert discussions from any real issues and talk about class warfare issues.
Yes.
And she is highly trained in that. I mean, this is a woman who's 30 or 31 years old, just now graduating from law school. Happens all the time. My grandfather didn't graduate from law school, I don't think, until he's 55 or 56. So it does happen. But the fact is that guys like Seidman are there to train these people, and it's not as passive participants in the legal process. It is using the legal process in an attempt to reshape society.
Absolutely.
And that's the entire point here.
But it's hard to reshape society when you have hard and fast parameters that have been built around the foundation of that society called the Constitution of the United States.
And therein lies the rub.
Yes, it is.
What guys like Louis Michael Seidman, not all, but much of the faculty at Georgetown Law School, many fame, Harvard Law, Yale Law, University of Chicago Law. You can come up with any major law school that's kicking out.
Ad infinitum, ad nauseam.
Yeah, exactly. And what they're coming up with is this idea that we need to engage in what's known as a meritocracy.
Ah, well, there's a new word for us, meritocracy.
Now, yes.
What does that mean, Charles?
Well, what it means is that the elite know better how to run things. And because of their stature and their mental capabilities, they need to be unbridled by limits on their power and authority. So in other words, what we need to do is restructure society to put these legal, historical, social elites in charge of, and even we can even do it by the elective process. But we need to limit it to these elites so that they can be not limit them with the fetters of things like the Constitution.
Well, they don't want to be limited. Now, according to Seidman, in his op-ed piece in the New York Times, which we talked about yesterday, he said this specifically, Chuck. He said, countries like Britain and New Zealand have systems of parliamentary supremacy and no written constitution, but are held together by long-standing traditions, accepted modes of procedure, and engaged citizens. We, too, could draw on these resources. What has preserved our political stability is not a poetic piece of parchment, but entrenched institutions and habits of thought, and, most important, the sense that we are one nation and must work out our differences. Is that the same way that the Occupy Wall Street movement is trying to work out their differences with corporations, and homosexual rights proponents are really trying to work out their issues with the church? And Chuck, I'm sorry, I think Seidman is being a Pied Piper.
Well, he's also being disingenuous because he's calling upon essentially the British government, the form of government, the parliamentary form, as an example of what he wants to do. And then the fact is that the British government has been limited by documents like the Magna Carta.
That's right.
Since 1215.
That's right.
Now, that did evolve.
And the English Petition of Rights.
That's right.
And we could just keep going on with a number of documents that frame the common law.
And what he doesn't realize is that Britons fought and died to maintain that liberty from the attempt to create meritocracy.
Well, of course, the divine right of kings, and when King John in 1215, and all the way up through the last of the Stuart kings, who decided that the divine right of kings,
the king
spoke for God and therefore could never be challenged, was challenged first by Oliver Cromwell and then by William and Mary, or William of Orange, who was brought over for the Glorious Revolution of 1688.
Yeah, and the reason it's called the Glorious Revolution was that James II took one look, decided he was beat, and left before William's army had to fire a shot.
That's right. It was a bloodless revolution.
Yes. And basically what happened is, you have to remember that what Seidman has forgotten is that William only agreed to take the crown on the basis that he become a constitutionally limited monarch.
Yep, see, but Seidman, he has this utopian vision, Chuck. He says, no one can predict in detail, get it, in detail, what our system of government would look like if we freed ourselves from the shackles of constitutional obligation. I got an idea about that. I can look at a number of countries where that's the situation.
Barry, we are freed from the shackles of constitutional constraint right now. This is what it would look like in this country.
This is what it's looking like, and it's a big problem.
And in fact, there's a reason that we are fighting to maintain the integrity of the Constitution, and it's because we believe that we can return to its limits, not the fact that the limits are in place. No one pays attention to the limits of the Constitution anymore. The federal government has not been limited by, the Congress has not been limited in its power by Article 1, Section 8 since the Civil War, and even before the Civil War.
No, absolutely.
Because federal money was being dispersed to build things like roads and canals, and there is no constitutional authority to do that.
Right. Now, Seidman again.
Well, except for post-roads.
Well, true.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Seidman, though, he's taking this to the next obvious level, and if his opinion piece is basically the entire thesis of his book, I don't think I have to buy a copy of it, even in the 1 cent bin. And he says here that, and I quote from him, he says, it would become apparent that people who disagree with us, see, there's that magical us.
Yes, the we.
He's undefined, but that's your meritocracy you're talking about. That disagreed with us about the Constitution are not violating a sacred text or our core commitments. Instead, we are all invoking a common vocabulary to express aspirations. Well, you know what's the difference between an aspiration by somebody who has no power and an aspiration by somebody who does have power?
Yeah, the guy with the no power.
The completion of the aspiration. That's
right.
That's
the guy who has aspirations and no power doesn't get it done. The guy who has aspirations and has the power gets it done.
Gets it done. He says, and of course, that doesn't mean that people agree at the ground level. If we are not to abandon constitutionalism entirely, and ultimately that is his preferred place to be, then we might at least... So he's saying, if we can't get what I really want, which is just basically abandon constitutional entirety and you let us tell you how to live, then we might at least understand it as a place for discussion. It's lovely how people who are trying to say, we need to get rid of all of your bad thinking, want to then discuss with you.
Oh, right. I've run into this recently in debates on gun control with everybody. You're not being reasonable.
Right. It's us versus you, and you're unreasonable. And he says this here. A demand that we make a good faith effort. Well, now he's trying to say that people who hold the Constitution are not acting in good faith to understand the views of others. How dare you try not to understand my view, Professor Seidman? Rather than as a tool, and I'm quoting from him, to force others to give up, get this, Chuck, their moral and political judgment. In other words, if we say we've got to adhere to the document that is the foundation of our governance, that is a protection against tyranny, and that has served us very well for over 235 years. I hate to tell you, Professor Simon, you kind of got your math wrong. That what we're doing is we're using it as a tool to force him and the meritocracy to give up their moral judgment and their political judgment. In other words, isn't that the same thing that he's really demanding of us?
Exactly. And let me ask a question. From a presuppositional basis, what's his morality based on? What is his moral judgment based on?
Right now, it's based upon whatever whim he has.
Exactly. It's based on himself.
Yes, it's based on him.
The fact is, what these guys don't like is that people like Barry and I and a lot of the people out in the audience on WLRY and on our podcasts base our moral decisions on something outside of ourselves, something that is constant. And again, he has made the point in the past that the two ways of looking at law and the two ways of looking at liberty and the two ways of looking at limits on powers, that there are limits and that there aren't limits, are not compatible.
No, they're not.
And they are not compatible. Barry, this is what led to, you can say anything you want to about the Civil War, but the fact is, this is what led to the war between the states.
It is a major factor.
Two vastly different ways of the view of law. And you can throw in slavery as the emotional issue, and we don't want to get into that because that's not really why the war was fought. It's part and parcel, but it had to do with economics and constitutional interpretation. And unfortunately, we're getting to a place where, again, these two things are coming into loggerheads.
They are. And let me tell you how Seidman uses the verbiage to try to frame it so that one side is always wrong. Like he said, one side's decisions are always wrong. He says, even if this change is impossible, and he's talking about this whole idea about having this discussion with these people who are trying to force them to give up their morality, of course, if even this change is impossible, perhaps the dream of a country ruled by we the people is impossibly utopian. But his we is very narrow we. It's not an all-encompassing we. It's we the meritocracy.
Exactly. It's the elite.
And he says, if so, we have to give up on the claim that we are a self-governing people who can settle our disagreements through mature and tolerant debate. So in other words, if we cede to his position, we're being mature and tolerant. If we say, au contraire, we believe that you're wrong, all of a sudden we're being immature and intolerant.
Exactly.
What a surprise. Here we go again. It's the marginalization of anybody who's different than they are. But before abandoning our heritage of self-government, by sticking to the Constitution, of course, we ought to try extricating ourselves from constitutional bondage. You know, Jefferson had a thought about that, Chuck. He said, the tyranny,
that's
let
right.
them be bound by the
chains
of the Constitution.
And by them, he meant the rulers.
The rulers.
The ruling class.
Now, but here, Seidman says, we ought to try extricating ourselves from constitutional bondage so that we can give real freedom a chance.
And
now, that's real freedom from he and the elite, the academes, the elitist political types, the elitist social types, to basically demand what everybody else does.
Oh, we're out of time, but what this means is, he wants us to be free from anything that would encumber us from living a life. They will make all the decisions for us, but we can be free to be slaves.
Be free to be slaves. That's what it is. Folks, forget about buying a copy of On Constitutional Disobedience. Go out and buy yourself a copy of the Constitution. They're real cheap. We even sell them on our website
That's
at
right.
principlepolicy.com. You'll learn more from that and from listening to this program than Professor Seidman is ever going to be able to teach you.
Spend $60 and take one of our Constitution classes and learn what it's really all about.
That's That's it.
Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.